The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Matt, why not? I'd drive all the way up from Cape Breton and land there a minute late. Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting to order. I'd like to remind everyone to place their phones on silent so we don't have any interruptions. We'll begin with introductions of committee members, starting with Mr. Farrell.
Good morning, I'm Terry Farrell, the MLA for Cumberland North.
Suzanne Lonas-Croft, MLA Lunenburg.
Good morning and thanks for being here. I'm Margaret Miller, the MLA for Hans East.
Joachim Strong, Halifax, Shebucto.
Ian Rankin, Timberley Prospect.
Good morning, my name is Tim Houston, I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning, Maureen McDonald, Halifax, Needham.
Good morning, Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness, your chair. Mr. Pickup, perhaps you could introduce yourself, and your colleagues can introduce themselves, and you can begin with your opening comments.
Good morning, Michael Pickup, Auditor General.
Terry Spicer, Deputy Auditor General.
Evangeline Coleman said, Assistant Auditor General.
Anne McDonald, Assistant Auditor General.
Thank you, Mr. Pickup. And, of course, today we have the Auditor General with us to discuss the Fall 2015 report. Mr. Pickup, please proceed.
I would like to thank the committee for your interest in our work and for calling us here today. This, of course, is a critical part of our system of accountability. We are here to help you in holding government accountable, and we like and enjoy being called as witnesses on our report and on our work. I want to thank all of the departments who were under audit during this report. Their cooperation remains essential to the work that we do. I would also like to thank the approximately 36 people in our office and the three people with me today for doing these five audits, which cover so much of what government does. In answering the questions today, we don't have a lot of introductory comments. I will remind you at times, I'm sure, as will my colleagues, that we do realize we tend to stick to the report, and we are answering questions related to the audit work we do. So we don't attempt to frustrate you in some of our responses where we indicate additional information is likely better provided by the department. So I'll just mention that sort of from the outset. So I'm not going to do a summary opening. The report has been public for a week. We met with you last week for 2 hours. So that's it for introductory comments.
Thank you, Mr. Pickup. And we'll begin with Mr. Houston for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your introductory comments and for doing the report on these important topics. So first off, I want to start off with the education, Department of Education. And I noticed that some of your goals for doing this audit were to consider how boards monitor and oversee educational outcomes, And I know that your conclusion was that they're not providing adequate oversight over these things. And also to determine if the Department of Education is providing adequate oversight and monitoring of educational services. And you concluded that the department has not met that standard either. So in considering those conclusions, my mind was thinking about a few different things as to, you know, how we can provide a better education to the children of the province and whether the boards and the department are kind of acting on things to provide that. And one of the things I was thinking about was the actual learning environment, the actual setup of the schools and the way that the schools are how welcoming they are to students, let's say, right? And I know in my constituency in Pictou East, there's a situation that's happening right now at Pictou East Middle School, where they had a full-time custodian retire. So instead of replacing that full-time custodian, the board has decided to rely on maybe nighttime custodial services, but the union contract says that a custodian can only deal with so much square footage. So the board's actually closing down things like the learning center at the school and making these types of moves, all to pigeonhole things into getting around spending less on custodial services. To me, that seems that that's really to the detriment of the students and really degrades the learning environment. And I wonder if through the course of your audits, you came across any situations, any types of analysis that might have been done by boards that said, well, if we trim this or cut this, this is how we can save a few bucks, particularly around spaces that I think should be available to kids, like libraries and learning centers and stuff. Did you come across any types of analysis at the board level over those types of things? Anything specific to that school, too, would be of interest to me, obviously. But even in general, did you come across anything where that type of analysis is being done?
Mr. Pickup.
So the scope of this audit was very much on the oversight of educational results. So the types of things that you're looking at, for example, financial analysis, budgeting, that wouldn't have been part of the scope of this audit.
So when I think, but you did some work around what they call continuous school improvements, goals of always making the learning environment better. To me, this is the type of thing that's absolutely contrary to making continually trying to make an improvement to school environments. It's making them, I think it's degrading them. So in that context, did you have any thoughts on those types of situations where these aren't making our schools better, these types of board decisions? What are your thoughts on that?
Ms. Coleman said.
So we did look at the continuous school improvement process, but very much that process is a framework that the department has that looks at monitoring student progress. So it's looking at things like, for example, school might have a numeracy goal, and then some strategies for how they're going to achieve that. So it really wouldn't get into some of these areas that you're referencing.
So the boards don't really, it's not a consideration of theirs of the of how the actual learning environment is structured and how it may be more conducive to learning. That's not really something that in your experience or through the course of this audit you thought boards are considerate of?
It wasn't part of the focus of the audit, so we were very much looking at sort of how they monitor educational outcomes and whatnot and what board's knowledge is of that and the oversight of that. So it wasn't part of the focus of the audit. It wasn't something that we would have looked at.
Okay, it's definitely something that the board should be considerate of. And I know at another school in my area, McLeod School, I mean, last year it was under construction. No construction in the summertime, but in the wintertime when school was in, there was lots of construction being done. At that very school now this year, the kids can't play on the playground. The playground's been closed for about a month. And I think that that's a real disservice to kids, and that's why I was curious in the context when I was reading your work around continuous school improvements, if boards are really, you know, have their minds opened to what that means, and it sounds like they really don't. It's quite a narrow focus on how they would see improving schools as to maybe how the layperson would see improving schools. So it's kind of a general comment on that. I don't know if you want to respond to that.
And again, I don't want to give the impression that I think or that the office thinks that the board's focus in that regard is narrow, because we didn't look at that. So that wasn't part of the focus of the audit. Continuous school improvement process is really about monitoring student education process. It's a specific program that the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development has that boards and schools are responsible to implement. We did look at that in a number of schools, but again, it would have been with a focus on what are the learning outcomes that they're looking at, you know, what's... So I think, you know, you're looking at maybe continuous school improvement as covering a very broad area, whereas it is a very specific thing that's probably got a bit of a narrow focus. There may or may not be attention in those other areas. I don't know, because it wasn't part of what we looked at.
I think I was thinking about it in the context, if you're going to monitor student outcomes, which we, of course, know from the SAW that's not being done very well, sadly. But if you are going to monitor student outcomes, then you should react to what you find. And I think that's a good place to look for making sure that environments are better structured for learning. And these are a couple areas that I think are really falling down, and I hope somebody starts to look at them. Did you, through the course of your audit, you wouldn't have come across anything around the capital budgeting process? We have a capital budget that comes out around this time every year for what schools would have, additions and alterations or new schools. Would that have been anything that you covered as part of your audit? And you wouldn't have done any of that analysis?
No, that wasn't part of the scope of the audit.
Okay. And in terms of the IPP programs, so you found in your audit that boards don't receive or review progress reports for students on IPPs. I think that's a fair summary of your finding there, that they don't receive or review any reports on that. But did the board look at the extent of differentiated instruction that's actually taking place? I see you had a chart in your report that said that, you know, a certain percentage of children in these three different boards were on IPPs and stuff. But did you see anything in the course of your audit that where there was any review by the board on that number, in terms of, was that what they expected in terms of how many students should be receiving differentiated instruction? Was it higher? Was it lower? Or did they just get the number and say that's the number?
There really isn't a whole lot happening at the board level in terms of IPPs. IPPs are, by definition, individual to each student. So what we were looking to see was that there was some overview information coming to the board level that would say, you know, are students generally meeting these or not, that sort of thing. And there just wasn't, generally speaking, very much information about IPPs coming to the board level at all.
To me, that's wrong. Do you have an assessment of whether that's... I don't think that's fair to the students. I think the board should be paying attention to these types of things and should be wanting to improve that. Do you have any sense of whether were they failing? Was the board failing in that aspect, or is that just the way it is?
So recommendation 2.6 on page 21 of the report speaks to the need for all three of the boards that we did audit work at to receive and review reports on student progress, including individual program plans.
Okay, and are you happy with the responses you got? This is kind of a general question at first, but are you happy with the responses you got from the boards?
Mr. Pickup.
So the first part
Mr. Pickup.
The first part that I am happy with is that the three boards agree with the recommendations. Now, having said that, we don't sort of give an advance ruling, if you will, in terms of, yes, this will meet it, or the probability of this being implemented. So I think the first step is encouraging that the recommendation is agreed to. But the most important thing, I think, is the accountability around these organizations actually implementing what they've agreed to do on a timely basis.
And in terms of the actual, so they've agreed with them. I do think we see that as a pattern, that most departments always agree with your recommendations. They rarely actually do anything to change it. But in terms of the responses that you came back this time, they agreed. That's good. What they said they're going to do to fix it, are you generally quite happy that that will actually address it? Or like, what's the process when you get that? Is it once they say what they're going to do, is that okay? Or?
So generally the process in terms of responses to the recommendations, we give a certain amount of time near the end of the audit to see if the organizations that we audit agree with the recommendation, and then they get a chance to put in the response. So here they give a response. However, we don't pre-audit, if you will, what the response is. We generally accept the response as is written in a certain, you know, generally a fairly confined space. So you see, you know, a paragraph of 7 or 8 lines, and then we will come back. We'll give 2 years for the entities to implement the recommendations. We will come back in 2 years to see if these have been indeed implemented.
That's fair enough. But I think what I'm coming to as I read some of their responses and stuff is, I actually feel like in many cases, and this is certainly not meant to be a reflection of your department, but in many cases in this particular report, I feel like the school boards are dancing around the recommendations, and I've got a couple examples, but I'd like to kind of share one with you. Like, if I look at your recommendation 2.6, and if I look at specifically the Chignecto Central's response, in their response, in their second sentence there, they say, summarized assessment data, including provincial board or school-based results. When I see something like that word or school-based results, like that should say and. And I guess what I was reading these, I was reading their responses, and I was thinking to myself, if I was an elected school board member and I was going to receive information from these school boards, would I be able to understand it, particularly in the right context? And a response like that suggests to me that the school board leaves the door wide open for themselves to pick and choose what they're going to, it leaves the door wide open. And that's why something like, that's why I was curious if, you know, how you accept the responses, because I presume you don't have much ability to say to them, that's not good enough, you should be giving them that and this, or how does that, just kind of a blanket question on, I can see them getting cute in their responses. Let's say that. And I imagine you probably see them getting cute in their responses too, but I'm wondering what is it, are your hands kind of tied on that?
We would hope, and we would work with entities to the extent that we can in a fairly short period of time to say, okay, and we would encourage entities to try to make the responses to recommendations specific. To make them something that people can hold them to account for. I think at the end of the day, the work we do to promote economy and efficiency and effectiveness is generally well received by the entities that we audit. And I encourage entities directly and indirectly through my colleagues that if you don't agree, have the discussion. So I don't think it's a question of not agreeing. And if it's going to take time to implement, you know, don't be afraid to put those stages in there.
Maybe ask, because this is unique. Where you have the department, you have the boards, and you have the schools. This is a unique situation. Maybe I'll ask another question. Presumably, the Department of Education must have had some reaction to your findings of how the boards were operating. Is that a reaction that they would have shared with you? Would they have been surprised that the boards were, you know, subject to these types of... Were they surprised by your findings with how the boards are operating, the Department of Education?
So the Department of Education would, you know, formally respond to the recommendations that are addressed to them. So we try to very much respect the governance process that is in place, with the department having a certain role, the governing boards having a role, and management having a role. So I wouldn't look to the Department of Education, for example, to respond to a recommendation to a board.
Even informally? Because the board is subordinate to the department. And I think this is part of the whole problem with what we see, right? The department is relying on the board to fulfill some duties. And I think what this report shows is that those aren't always being fulfilled. As the boss of the boards, I would think the department would be disappointed. Is that something that they would share with you, either informally or formally? So, maybe you're saying the formal mechanism is not for you to ask them about the board's responses, but maybe it should be.
So I wouldn't speak for the department or for the minister as head of the department, but I'm comfortable that the reaction to all of the recommendations within this report are well received and are respected as adding value and wanting to be addressed by anybody that I have met with, respecting the governance model that we have.
Is you, from your experience now with a couple different audits, I guess now, what can you tell us about the culture that exists between the department and the boards? Is there a good, strong working relationship there, or is it what have you observed about that relationship?
So I think the important thing for me is to stick to the specifics of how we looked at that relationship in terms of the audits that we did and the respective roles of people within, keeping in mind the number one goal here in terms of doing this audit is, at the end of the day, what is the oversight of educational results, right? It's not necessarily about the culture itself. So the example I would give you would be in here in the role of the regional school officers of the Department of Education and the role that they play between the department and the school boards. And we made a recommendation around that as to how that can be improved. So I think it's better for me to talk about specific examples of things that can go better under this governance model than sort of generalizations or things that aren't related to the audit in terms of things
Fair
like
enough.
Culture.
So I guess in looking at the number of ways you said it can go better, I guess I should reach my own generalization about how it's working, I guess, and that's, I accept that. In terms of the, I know I'm a little short on time here, Mr. Chair, 2 minutes, so I would like to just in this round ask an initial question about the funding to universities. Now, the government removed the cap on the tuitions that the universities could charge. And I know one day in question period here last week, to a rather thunderous applaud from her colleagues, the minister tried to say that they didn't uncap tuitions. But there's quite a few students around the province, I think, that have a different assessment of whether there's a cap was removed or not. We all know the reality of that. I'm wondering about, if you're through the course of your audits, you may have seen any work papers prepared by the department or any university that showed how much revenue they could raise from an uncapping of tuitions, and whether that analysis was put into context of how that will help the overall financial position of the universities. So in other words, did they do analysis as to how much more money they could bring in from tuitions, and how that fit into the broader scheme of their financial troubles, or did they just say, go for it?
Ms. Coleman said.
So one of the aspects of the memorandum of understanding between the province and universities related to tuition, in terms of looking at that, our work was limited to sort of what they did underneath that memorandum of understanding, and so that involved setting standard tuition changes and whatnot. So at the point in time when we did that work, that's where that situation was, and that's what we would have looked at as part of our work under the memorandum.
Okay. I think I'm out of time, Mr. Chair.
You do have about 25 seconds if you want to use that period of time.
So 25 seconds. I think I'll pass my 25 seconds.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
We'll move to Mr. Wilson of the NDP caucus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome back for the second week in a row. Appreciate the work that your office has done with these chapters, because I think they touch upon a number of extremely important services that Nova Scotians count and rely on, and having a review of what's going on and how we can how government can improve the service is extremely important. So I want to start with Chapter 2 around the school boards and governance and oversight. You've had some strong comments on the findings in the audit, and I think the one that stands out the most to me when I read through the report was the one when you indicated that school board oversight is lacking in the audits that you've done, and I realize you did three regional school boards. Who's ultimately responsible to ensure that the school board's school board oversight is robust or is adequate? Who in the at the end of the day, who's ultimately responsible to ensure that oversight is appropriate?
Ms. Coleman said.
So, as an elected board, governing board obviously has a role to play in ensuring that there is appropriate oversight. In the instance of school boards, the Education Act does define them as accountable to the minister at the end of the day. So there's an accountability relationship there. Now, one of the things that we identified in the report is that the Education Act kind of creates a conflicting accountability for boards in that accountable to the minister and accountable to the electorate. And, you know, there's a conflict there, or potential conflict that we've highlighted in the report. But certainly, as a governing board, they should be making sure that their oversight is adequate.
Yeah. No. And thank you for that, because it is. I think at times it is difficult to distinguish exactly where that should lie. Where we do have two levels of government, really. I don't think, and I know over the last 12 years as an elected official, many people bypass the reality that we have elected school board members, but ultimately the governance of that it lies with the government and lies with the minister. And I think that's why it's so important to ensure that we have appropriate and robust oversight with the school boards when you do have that. And through your report, some of the things that stand out do concern me, especially around one of the findings of that there was times when the minister or the department withheld information from those elected school board members, and that I believe is something that needs to be corrected immediately. I know we asked the minister in question period on this, and we'll continue to try to find out more information on when is it appropriate for a minister or a department to withhold information. Would you have a comment on that? Is there a time when the department should be withholding information from the elected school board members?
Mr. Pickup? Sorry, Ms. Coleman said.
So, as indicated, there are instances in which the department is setting embargoes on information. So, the recommendation that we have made in here is that the department needs to very clearly establish some direction around that so that school board management know what they can and cannot share, and what the parameters around that are. Right now, there have been some longer time periods where information was embargoed. And some of those might be, for example, instances where there's preliminary results and they're still finalizing them, and so they're perhaps not entirely ready for release, that they might share them with a superintendent level or something like that. But really what we're getting at in here is that there needs to be very clear direction around when that's going to take place, and certainly time periods covered by the length of the embargo should definitely be restricted as much as possible and shortened as much as possible. You don't want information with board management for months that the governing board can't access.
Are you satisfied with the department's response on that? And maybe that's early to ask, but I'll ask it anyways. With the response, and are you encouraged that they'll take your advice and implement more of a structured governance or oversight, especially with embargoed information. I mean, that it should be concerning to people to know that, you know, some information is being withheld from elected school board members who are ultimately there to represent a district within that school board. So are you satisfied at this point with the one, with the response they gave you, and two, that you're confident that the changes will be made to improve that situation?
Mr. Pickup.
A three-part answer to that question. The first part is, I think the response, if you look on page 14, was fairly specific in terms of actions and in terms of referring to what happened on October 8th and what happened on October 9th. So that was a very positive step. Also in that response, there was indication that the department is examining the option of a standard embargoed period. So as with any of our recommendations and the response, we hope that will happen sooner rather than later. And the third part of my answer would be, you know, as I mentioned earlier, any of these responses, we hope for things that are specific and detailed, but we don't give sort of an assessment of the probability of these things happening or based on the amount of detail given, whether it would fully meet the recommendation.
With your on the first page of your audit, in your finding, you said what we found in our audit. One of the statements here that stand out is the one that indicated the department has not set clear expectation for school board performance, which I would assume would lead into, I would think, or would have an effect of the performances of the students. Am I correct in saying that if the department has not set clear expectations for the school board, then I would assume that the expectation on our students would be hurt also if that's not defined right at the start? Am I correct in saying that, or would you agree with that?
Mr. Pickup.
What I would agree with is, if you refer to page 11, we are fairly clear that the department, indicating the department has not developed performance expectations for school boards, and that the only evaluation of student educational achievement is the provincial assessment process. So we've made a very, you know, strong and clear recommendation that we think performance standards need to be met. And then I would, you know, sort of draw your attention again to the summary page in the chapter on page 9, where we list all of the school boards across the province, across literacy and math for both grade 3, 4, and 6, and the results that are there.
And, I mean, the provincial assessment, if I'm correct, and I have kids in the school system, they're not done, the provincial assessment aren't done in every grade, correct?
Ms. Coleman said?
That's correct. There's certain assessments in certain grades, grade 3, grade 4, grade 6, and it varies. Sometimes it's a literacy and a numeracy. Sometimes it might be one or the other.
So I mean, that should be a concern, because if there is an area where students are having difficulties, it may be a couple years before a provincial assessment will shine some light on the curriculum, if that's where changes is needed. I would assume, with the audit, that's why the comment was made that the government is not meeting the goals of the Education Act. I mean, that's another strong statement that I've read in this chapter. Could you just maybe a little more expand on that, the reasoning behind that statement, that the government is not meeting the goals of the Education Act?
So you are correct. It does relate to the matter of whether or not performance expectations have been established. I mean, the department is responsible to develop the curriculum, but also responsible for the delivery of ultimately how educational services are getting delivered throughout the province. And without performance expectations, you know, when provincial assessments are done, what's a good result on those? Did this board do, you know, one board may have done better than the other, than say another board, but perhaps the bar should be higher than what either achieved, or perhaps they've both met the bar. So in the absence of targets, you know, boards really don't know sort of what is it that the department expects them to achieve?
And I know you only had the time and maybe the resources to do three of the school boards, but could we speculate that the other boards are you would have found similar findings if you had the opportunity to review all the school boards in the province?
Mr. Pickup.
So with the addition of these three school boards and the Tri-County School Board last year, we probably have covered off roughly 68% of students. We won't try to project these or extrapolate these to the other school boards, but I mean some of the recommendations in here related to the department would stand, so adding more school boards wouldn't make a difference. We would hope that any school board, you know, across the province who wasn't part of this audit would look at the results of this audit and see what they can do. I would also suggest that in relation to results, if you look at the summary on page 9, a year ago, you know, we were here to talk about Tri-County, and we had produced and presented the 13-14 results, and this summary presents the 14 and 15 results for the Tri-County as well, which would make for an easy comparison on those educational results and some of which probably, if you're looking for a percentage increase, didn't go in that direction, went in the other direction.
Yeah, thank you. And we appreciate you providing those charts, even though it was outside the scope of your audit, because they do, those numbers are important. And I think, you know, parents who have children in those school boards, and that school board would definitely want to see the government move in the direction that would hopefully improve outcomes. Oversight is extremely important, as we've just heard. Within the department, I believe, and you talked about it on page 12 of your audit, were the fact that there's regional education officers. And I believe there's five of them. Or there was indication that there was five regional education officers. Are you able to tell us if all five of those positions were they filled when you did the audit, and are they currently filled? Is there any vacancies that you're aware of?
Ms. Coleman said.
To my knowledge, at the time we did the audit, they were filled. Whether or not there are any vacancies at the moment, I couldn't speak to, because, of course, we finished the audit a little while ago. But at the time we did the work, they were all staffed.
Thank you. And I think I asked this when we met last week in camera. But, I mean, who do they report to? And I don't recall the answer. I don't know if I wrote it down somewhere. But I mean, would they report to the minister? Would they be housed within the department, or are they out within maybe the regional school board somewhere? So do you know if they're in the department, and do they report to management or senior management or the deputy or the minister?
So the REOs are housed within the department, although they certainly do spend time out in the boards as well. For example, they will often attend board meetings. Certainly all of the board meetings that I attended as part of this audit, there was always an REO there. And in terms of who they report to, I couldn't recall last week, but I have since checked, and they report to a director or executive director level, kind of depending in the department. So,
and where, did you come across, or did you look for like a job description? I mean, I would think if you have regional education officers who are liaison between the minister and the department or the school boards, I mean, that their job description should be important, it should be known, and maybe that's part of the reason why we're seeing not an effective oversight. Did you come across that in your audit, or did you not? Was that not part of the audit?
So we would have looked at their job description as part of it, but we haven't reported the details of that. What we have talked about in the chapter is the fact that it's not clear sort of how often they're to report to the department and that sort of thing. So I guess frequency of reporting isn't a level of detail I would necessarily expect to see in a job description. It's a level of detail I'd expect to see in more of an operational process outside of that. And for the REOs, there's definitely some work that's needed in that area.
Okay, thank you, and hopefully that will help with that oversight. I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to stay on this, and maybe the second round we'll be able to get into some university questions. One of the areas that was alarming to me also was around the examination of drills, fire drills, and I'm trying to think of the lockdown drills. And there, you had provided a chart for in the audit. I understand, and I would appreciate all your recommendations are important and should be looked upon as trying to implement as quickly as possible. But that one stands out for me. I mean, having kids in the school system today, I would hope that the school that they attend are following the rules and are adequately educating our students on what to do, especially in today's atmosphere. I think I mentioned this last week. I recalled it wasn't in the school itself, but Cole Harbour High had a lockdown recently because of a shooting or alleged shooting the next street over. So are you confident that they responded adequately and appropriately and quickly enough, and that we shouldn't be waiting for 2 years for your next update to make sure that that aspect of your audit has been addressed by the minister and by the school board?
Mr. Pickup.
So an important part of this recommendation lies in the response as well. When it became clear to us the information that is in that summary table on page 47, we communicated with the department our concern around this, and given the timing that it was within the first 10 days of school, the department, as they indicate in their response, they reached out to the superintendents and shared this information with them and notified their staff to direct schools to complete and record a fire drill within, for example, the first week. Now, that is one aspect of this. This covers a number of things. We did not, as part of this audit, go back and make sure that that was actually not only communicated but actually done, which is probably the more important part. But I think that's a fair question for the department as the ones who sent out the information.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I go quickly to university funding. There seems to be a constant theme when you did the audit with the school boards, universities, and also the universities aspect of it, that you indicated that Nova Scotia universities the findings with the university funding is that it needs updating and more accountability. Maybe a quick comment on, you know, that why you indicated that the accountability was lacking with university funding. I believe you may have even said university fund. Or that one. Actually, I'll leave it at that one, and then I'll come to my second question.
Mr. Pickup.
So I would probably, as a quick answer, refer you to page 51, where we found that the department was not regularly monitoring the financial health of the universities and that the funding model has not been updated in some time.
Yeah, because, I mean, the statements, I was trying to find it. We have a lot of paperwork in front of us when we're trying to do these. Mm-hmm. The comment was most university funding is provided without any accountability. Are you satisfied with the reaction of the government and their commitment to try to change the accountability with regards to university funding?
So our recommendations are fairly specific in here and have been agreed to by the entities. Now, having said that, now the important part is seeing the recommendations implemented. So to the extent they are implemented in a reasonable way on a timely basis, therein will lie the answer, and I cannot at this point sort of give a an advanced probability of this being implemented on a timely basis, but I think it's a great question for the departmental officials.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Right on time, we'll move to the Liberal Caucus and Mr. Rankin.
Yes, thank you. And I do want to have to ask questions on the education component. I think there are some good questions today on the whole accountability and how the system works. But it should be recognized that the department is concerned, and that was the impetus behind asking for this report to be conducted. So there is some information, and I'd be interested to see how the committee can support seeing these recommendations through. So I guess my first question, when you say that the department's not clearly defining the role of the school boards or meeting its responsibilities under the Education Act, do you see that the Act itself needs to be better defined, or is it actually the implementation of the Act itself? Because you do kind of speak around the Act, and I'm just wondering, what mechanism is there is there something within the Act that you think would provide better certainty and predictability?
Mr. Pickup.
So the government could clarify the accountabilities under the Act if they chose, to make sure that the roles and responsibilities are fairly clear. But most of the recommendations that we make are under sort of the current situation that we have and wouldn't necessarily take legislative change to put in place.
Did you look at other provinces and how they implement their Act, or is that outside of the scope?
Ms. Coleman said.
We would not have looked at other provinces. We wouldn't have any mandate to look at those, and you have to be very careful when you just look at information in terms of what's available on the internet. Because you can, you know, things can be portrayed in a positive light, but if you actually delved into it, you may find shortcomings and issues, and so...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's risky to do that.
And there's different boards doing different things, and there's positives out of some, and they're not present in other boards. So in terms of sharing those best practices, how do you see, is that a department role to ensure that there's information sharing between the various boards?
Mr. Pickup.
So the answer to that has a couple of parts. I think ultimately the response... you know, is related to the governing model that we have in Nova Scotia. So I think ultimately boards, you know, have a large chunk of the responsibility here to implement these recommendations, and for boards that haven't been under audit to look at the results of this audit and say, you know, how can we do better? How do we know where we stand? Of course, having said that, the department has a role here as well, and if you look at, for example, the recommendation related to the drills, for example, you know, education, so the department, you know, stepped in and communicated with the superintendents of the school boards, just in terms of efficiency, I think, in terms of getting the information to them on an easy basis. So you know, it's not often our responses, I guess, are not simple. You know, in terms of the actions that are needed, because it reflects the system that we have.
Yeah, and you mentioned the regional education officers, and they're basically underutilized, and how the job description is not defined, as mentioned earlier. Are there other positions that you feel are underutilized? And I know you didn't go through detail into the department, but I'm just trying to figure out where there could be strengthening of the effectiveness of that delivery.
So I think the effectiveness of the delivery is really about the recommendations addressing shortcomings in performance. So I would say the recommendations in some cases apply to the boards, in some cases apply to the department, in some cases apply to management. So I would keep the response to that in the context of what we looked at, and fairly specific and addressed really to 10 key observations / recommendations to address areas that need to be improved.
Okay. Do you feel there's too many school boards, or you're not going to make an opinion on it? It seems like there's 10 with over 100 elected people, and maybe that in itself is hard to control.
Mr. Pickup.
So we audit, of course, under the governance scenario that we have. So, you know, it's not for us to determine how many school boards there should be. We say, given this is the structure that we have and this is the way things work, how can it be improved?
And you mentioned something about more reasonable time frames for that communication. Do you have any specifics on what you feel is a reasonable time frame?
Ms. Coleman said.
Is that in relation to the embargo? Sorry, where are you referring to there?
In the overall conclusion in terms of the sharing information with the boards, you state that there should be more reasonable time frames. So I'm just trying to narrow down into the specifics of what would be reasonable.
So we haven't stated exactly what we think a time period should be, but, for example, with the issue of the embargoed information, there were instances where a number of months went by where board management would have that information and the elected board would not. So that seems like a really long time. And what we had said to the department is, you know, look at sort of what is a reasonable time frame and why is it embargoed and how quickly are you able to get it out to the board. Mm-hmm. I know their response speaks to the use of in-camera meetings and whatnot,
right,
which can be helpful. And if it's okay, I'd just like to clarify something from earlier. A couple of questions ago, you mentioned something in relation to the REOs. And I think you said, and I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, you referred to me saying that the job description wasn't defined, and I just want to make sure that's clear. There is a job description. The issue we had with the REOs was that in terms of how the position is used, there's probably a lot of opportunity to better use the position in their relationship with the boards. Things, for example, like how often they report to the department are not defined. That's not really a level I would expect to find in a job description. I would expect that to be more in operational processes within the department. So I just want to be clear that I'm not saying they don't have a job description.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of, these are broad recommendations. So is it up to the department ultimately to create an action item list to address the communication barriers and the whole governance issue? So that would be up to the committee to ask the department to look at how they're going to address these issues.
Mr. Pickup.
In general or in relation just to the REOs?
Well, no, in general, but specifically how, like, the recommendation to define and communicate responsibilities of board management, governing boards, and the department, to me, that should be narrowed down into a concise list of exactly how that's going to work.
Mr. Pickup.
So what we have done in the recommendations is directed to the group that we think should be responsible. So if you look at recommendation 1 and 2 and 3, they are directed to the department. And then as you get into recommendation 2.4, for example, it is at management within the school boards, and then we have recommendations that are addressed to the governing school boards themselves.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Stroink.
Thank you very much. I kind of want to go through, back to the education side, and kind of follow up on my colleague from PICTO East, primarily on the IPP stuff. And I guess I just kind of want to walk through that part of the report. One of the things that I just want to kind of get a handle on, and looking at the numbers that are associated with the three boards, this is on page 20, from Chignecto and from Halifax and from the Strait, on average it's about, you know, the Strait is 6.8, 5.2 in Halifax, and 5.3% of the kids are on IPP within the school, within those Strait systems. Majority of those kids, I would assume, and this is a fair comment, and I'm trying to discern the numbers here, would be on the struggling end of the spectrum of in the school. So they're on the IPP because they're not succeeding in the school. And is that a fair comment to make on that, on those numbers?
Ms. Coleman said.
Yes, I think it would be. That's certainly what anecdotally we would hear when we're talking with the boards.
Okay. And I guess, and from there, I kind of want to go down the road of, you know, a child who ends up on IPP right now, looking at your report, without any follow through or any direction of the end goal of them being on IPP. There seems to be no end goal within the IPP. Once your child is on IPP, you're there. Is that a fair analogy to make?
So we would have looked at IPPs as part of doing this audit, but I really can't say whether or not there could be all kinds of IPPs out there that have goals for the students to get back on the regular curriculum. I don't know. I think we wouldn't have looked at a tremendously large number of IPPs. I mean, typically we would look at maybe 20 to 30, and those are so individual that I don't know that we would have a good sense from that of whether or not there's a lot of goals out there. And we were really looking at what kind of information the board is getting on IPPs, and do they know at more of an umbrella level whether or not those students are progressing as they should. So,
and I guess that's where I'm kind of going to 2.4 in your analogy. It's just kind of, you know, the number of, I think it's the second kind of sentence there, we expected governing board members to have information regarding the number of students on the individual programs, plans, existing trends, issues of concerns, and how these students are progressing against their individual goals. Mm-hmm. To me, they're not getting that information. The boards aren't. Is that fair?
That is correct.
Right. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is once a child is on IPP, they're kind of stuck there based on this report that I'm understanding. And I guess that's a problem that I see within the school boards, is that if there is no communication from the teacher to the principal to the school boards, then the child is set up for failure.
Mr. Pickup.
So what we are laying out here is that, okay, so students on individual programs, perhaps at the school level with the instructors, with the school management, they may be, you know, assessing progress, looking at that. That's what we're focusing on here is at the board level. It's, you know, part of the board's job is to hold management, the people working for them essentially, accountable. How do you hold people accountable for producing results, those results being progress, if you don't have that summary information to know whether these people are indeed progressing? So that, I want to focus on that being the point versus what is happening with an individual, with the perhaps the instructor or within a school, or a little more broadly than that. It's really about the people who are governing at the board level knowing, is this successful? And if not, what are we going to do about it?
Right, and I guess that's what I'm trying to think. To me, when I look at these numbers, and it's kind of sad in a way, because I think there's too many cooks in the kitchen, right? And I think that if this was managed at the principal level, then there's a bigger chance of the child to be able to succeed. On a board level, they have to manage all these schools, and there's so many boards that, again, there's another mechanism for setup for failure.
I would hope that at a board level, what would happen would be a board would get summary information, which doesn't have to be 500 pages, some summary information for the schools within their board. How are our students doing? You know, are 80% of our students making their individual achievements as laid out in their plans? No, we're at 10%. Okay, who are we going to talk to about this? Why is this happening? What do we need to do differently? And perhaps it's that the goals and plans that are set need to be tweaked. But at a board level, in the governing structure that we have, with 4,000 students in these three school boards on IPPs, you know, we feel strongly that this has to be happening at a board level so that they can answer to how are these students doing.
Fair, and I guess that's what I'm trying to pull out of you, is that yes, but does the board, with this governing system right now that we have, do you feel that the boards have a play in this? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I'm not sure, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen, you're not going to get the goals that are achieved done, right? So here, if you can manage this IPP within the school system, within the principal system, then there's a bigger chance of getting the child to succeed than it is to go up to the board level, one more level of bureaucracy to ensure that this is about the child getting off IPP, this is the child getting into progressing further, and I'm not sure if they're the way that it's set up here, that they have that chance.
The structure that we have and the way this is supposed to work is that the ones who are ultimately supposed to answer for this, for IPP students, just like the rest of the students, are the boards. So I would even go back to say I would put IPP, say, yeah, fine, they don't do provincial assessments, but I would ask the same question. You know, if you're looking at Chinecto Central and 69% of students hitting grade 6 math on the provincial assessments, I would go back to the board with the same question as I, you know, would on IPPs where they don't get the information. They are the ones who are responsible under this structure for the success and for the achievements. So what are they doing and what do they know?
Ms. Coleman said?
I just want to add, and I may be misunderstanding where you're going with this, and if I am, please feel free to tell me that. But with regards to the IPPs, I mean, really what we're getting at for the board is very much a summary level of information. So we're not suggesting, for example, that a governing board should be looking at, did student A meet the goals or did student B meet the goals? Very much that level of detail would be out at an operational level at a school. That's absolutely where we would expect to see that, is at a school level. It's the same thing with the provincial assessments for students that are on just the regular curriculum. So it's really about a board having a higher level of information and knowing, you know, some of the examples Mr. Pickup used, like are 80% of the students or 90 or is it 50 of all the students on an individual program plan meeting their goals. So it's really about rolling up a summary level of data, and that's an appropriate level for a governing board. Out in the details of sort of which specific students would definitely not be an appropriate level for a governing board.
Okay, and thank you for that, because that's kind of where I was worried that they're micromanaging the IPPs out of that level. Yeah. The other piece of this, and I don't know if you've looked at this, is at the school level, you know, is IPPs being used as an escape route for kids who said, you know what, we're going to put this child on IPP because we just can't manage that person. Maybe that person is still can succeed on the normal path, but it's just an easy solution to put them there. And I guess that's what I'm trying to understand too, is out of these numbers, is there any tool and mechanism to actually see how many of these kids actually need to be in IPP?
Mr. Pickup.
So we did not, as part of this audit, look at the integrity of the IPP system in terms of whether somebody should or shouldn't be. I think those are the type of questions that, you know, you would put to a board, for example. In this case, we gave you three examples of boards with certain number of students on IPP, but again, that question should go to the board.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ms. Miller.
How many minutes do you have?
You have about 3 minutes left, or sorry,
right.
2 minutes left.
All right. I'd like to change sectors and talk a little bit about natural resources. My past life, my husband and I had a forestry business, so when I hear $5 million in stumpage fees for the province, it's a little bit worrisome. I'm just wondering what the process, if you have any idea of what the process is in place, how do they evaluate stumpage? Is it on an honor basis? How does that work? Where do they get that number?
Mr. Spicer.
Thank you. So the stumpage fees, it's on an honor system. So operators will send in what they call quarterly stumpage returns, which basically they'll say this is how much we've harvested on these plots of land, and then they're stumpage, they have a stumpage fee that they apply, and basically so they do that on an honor basis and those things are paid. So in our report, one of the things that we highlighted was, you know, we thought there were some control weaknesses in there in how the department was able to look at those and see whether those amounts were reasonable or not. So we made some recommendations on how they could improve looking at them, doing some inspections, and making sure that the stumpage fees that the province is getting is reasonable.
And did you find that they were reasonable, or have you gotten to that point yet? I mean, how many acres did this entail for the $5 million? Or, you know, do you have some sense of what the expectation was?
I don't have the number of acres of what that would have applied to. And as far as reasonableness, we did do some testing on the stumpage returns that we looked at. And it's extremely difficult for us to know whether they're reasonable or not, because, you know, we can't go back in the field and do the inspections and stuff like that. But we did do a little bit of analysis to see whether they were, you know, they were in line with what the annual harvest plans would have been.
And we didn't see anything huge anomalies with respect to that. But it is something that I think the department should be doing to make sure that, you know, on a global basis, you know, these things do appear reasonable.
Right. And also, if we have time to talk a little bit about
order, I do apologize. I'll have to stop you there, but you can go at it in the next round. Move back to Mr. Houston for 14 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to go back just, if we may, to the IPPs, because I think my colleague from Halifax Shabakto is kind of spot on a lot of his concerns there. And I wanted to go back, because the board is not receiving adequate information about students on IPPs, let's say. And I guess they would probably say that's because they don't have the resources. Would that be a fair summary? I think if teachers were had more resources in the classrooms, they could do more for the students that are on IPPs. And I don't know if that kind of is that something that came up. Did the board say, well, you know, we don't have much information on IPPs because we don't have the manpower to focus on that, or is it just something that they really didn't seem that interested in getting the information on?
Ms. Coleman said.
For me, the sense I have of the lack of summary-level information coming up on IPPs relates much more to the fact that they're all individual. If somebody does a grade 3 provincial math assessment and it's based on a standard curriculum, you can look at 80% of the kids met the outcome on that, or 60% did, and what did you want, and is that good or bad? The IPPs are all really individual, and so I think perhaps some of the boards struggled with what does summary information look like for something that is so individual. So what we talked to them about was the fact that you could still get information on, generally speaking, our students on IPPs in your board achieving the goals of the student's IPP. And you don't need to get into the details necessarily of what those goals are to know whether or not most of them are meeting or most of them are not meeting. And then kind of going from there and looking at that.
So who should be responsible for making sure that students on IPP are getting the education that they deserve? Is it the teacher? Is it the principal? Is it the board? Is it the department? Because right now, everyone's kind of pointing fingers at each other, I would say, right? Somebody needs to take responsibility for this, and who would you suggest that that might be?
Mr. Pickup.
I would suggest, as our recommendation indicates, that while many people have responsibility, the boards ultimately are responsible for the oversight of education, so they need to get information. Similar to the point that we make in terms of educational results for students not on IPPs as well.
Okay. Well, we look forward to the time when we have the board or the department here to talk about IPPs further. So appreciate you doing that initial work on that. I did follow up on my colleague's comments about the stumpage revenue of the province. It surprised me as a low number. And I'd asked before if there was any analysis done compared to like other provinces just for a reasonableness check, and I don't think that was within the scope here. But the more I thought about it, I wondered, have you seen or was there any evidence that came up in the work papers of your review of a decrease in stumpage revenue to the province as the amount of biomass consumed increased? So I'm wondering what the impact on stumpage revenue to the province might have been by biomass.
Mr. Spicer.
I can answer that one fairly quickly in that, no, we didn't notice anything like that, nor you know, would we have been specifically looking for that type of analysis. But that would really be a question for the department.
Okay. And in terms of, you know, if you have a normal stand of trees, you'd have some hardwood and some softwood in there. And obviously, if you were able to harvest and pull out the hardwood, you'd get more in stumpage than you would if you just had a blanket thing. But is it in your understanding of the way it works? It's the honor system, so they're taking a stand of trees and just paying like an average stumpage, or what? Is there supposed to be different classes of stumpage revenue within a stand, or?
There is different fees based on the type of wood, but it is an honor system. They report based on their quarterly returns, and the stumpage fee is paid to them based on those returns. And as I indicated earlier, we think the controls need to be improved in that area just for the department to get a better feel for whether those are reasonable.
So really there's no process, there's no reasonableness check at the department level per se, is there?
No, not that sort of taking the analysis comparing to sort of annual harvest plans and stuff like that. Yeah. We didn't see that at all.
And there's not even any kind of like back at cigarette package, like Nova Scotia's put 10% hardwood. There's nothing that, there's nobody looking to say, well, did we get paid? You know, like there's just no reasonableness assessment done really.
Not at the level we were looking at. If there's something happening, sort of, at the district level, we're not aware of it. But again, we were looking for sort of a specific kind of a high level analysis to see whether, because in fairness, for inspectors to go out and make sure that it would be very virtually impossible because there's so many trucks of wood coming that to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. In extreme detail.
Did anyone kind of get caught for under-reporting stumpage? Did you find any examples of the department finding an instance where somebody under-reported stumpage? There's nobody been sanctioned for it or anything like that?
Not that we're aware of, no.
Okay. It can't be much more of an honor system than that system, I guess, eh? It's as honorable as it gets, maybe. But in terms of the funding to universities, I think there was talk last week about a structural deficit of $50 million that's looming. And I'm wondering about that number. I'm wondering if you have a breakdown of that number as to where that looming structural deficit comes from, like maybe by general categories of building infrastructure, wages. Is that a number that any analysis was done on?
Mr. Pickup?
So on, as you indicated on page 52, we make reference to the $50 million, but we don't provide a breakdown, so that question really is better suited for the department.
So that's a number that was provided to you?
That's right, the department provided that number.
Yeah, the department provided that number, okay. So that would be very interesting to see if, sometimes we hear about the compensation structure within the universities, and maybe a good portion of that $50 million is just because the people running them are budgeting some higher wage increases for themselves. But we don't know today as we sit here. It's the department that knows that.
Yes, you'd want to direct that question to the department, correct?
Okay, thank you. And the same thing, I guess, in the same vein, and I'll ask it anyway, but I'm sure it might not been in your scope. But I'm wondering about the current batch of tuition increases, if they will go any ways to reducing that $50 million looming deficit that's been reported. In other words, was there any kind of discussion or any evidence that you saw that there might have been a discussion that said, well, if you let us increase the tuitions just this one time, it won't be a $50 million looming deficit, it will be a $30 million. I don't know, pick a number, but is that anything that might have came out as part of your audit?
Ms. Coleman said.
So we wouldn't have information on the impact of the tuition increases that would have been outside of our audit period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was also curious about your 4.39, where it says that of 10 projects examined, this is in the innovation projects, I think, 10 examined, there were three that didn't have any associated cost-saving estimates. And they might not have had a cost-saving estimate in there, but hopefully there was some other stuff in the work paper file that said why these were good projects. What metric would they have been looking at with those types of projects if cost savings wasn't something they seemed to care about?
So there were some project criteria that that changed over time. Initially, there were some criteria related much more so to cost savings, and then in the fourth round of the funding, it also changed. If you see paragraph 4.382, criteria to consider projects that supported innovation and collaboration also linked to the province's economic and social goals. As for the specifics of those three particular projects, I can't recall, so I wouldn't be able to speak to those.
Okay. I do want to speak about procurement processes in my last couple minutes here. I know that in your June report, you looked at some of the procurement processes across government departments, and there was a procurement services compliance officer who was meant to carry out some compliance testing for government departments on procurement services. Are you aware of any such person within the Department of Education? Do they have a procurement services compliance officer in the Department of Education that might be checking how things are purchased?
I'm not aware one way or the other. I do believe a lot of the procurement is being centralized at the Department of Internal Services at the moment. That's, I guess, just general background knowledge from the audit work we did in procurement.
Right.
But I'm not aware of whether or not there was anyone specific at the Department of Education during the time period that would have been covered by our audit.
Okay.
I don't know.
And same would apply to the universities, I guess. There wouldn't be anyone looking at their procurement processes. They'd be doing that themselves, right?
They are outside the government reporting entity, so.
Yeah, okay. And now I'm wondering, did you, in the scope of your audit, did you come across any personal services contracts that the Department of Education might be using or any of the other departments that were covered by this audit? Is personal service contracts something that, that you're seeing used by these departments?
So that wouldn't have been part of the scope of this audit.
So it wouldn't be something it would be something that maybe should be something we would look at, I guess, going forward as an audit thing, would it? You did in a part chapter one time on, I think, professional services contracts and raised some concerns about how they were being used. I think that was at Communications Nova Scotia specifically in that instance, if you remember. But I'm wondering about a more widespread use of personal services contracts in these departments that you're looking at.
Mr. Pickup.
So we are currently gathering information and evaluating whether we will consider an audit of personal services contracts. So that is currently underway. And if we choose to do an audit there, we will follow our normal path of indicating on our website when we decide to do an audit. So as we move forward over the next period of month/months, then as we make that decision, we will communicate it to all Nova Scotians through our website.
Okay, thank you. And I just maybe give us a little sneak preview. Is it something in your early assessment as to whether you should do it? Is it something that you're finding that they're used in the government quite often, personal services contracts?
So I would only be able to answer that based on fact and scope. So, and I really don't have that information at this point. So I wouldn't be able to answer your question at this point.
Okay. So of course you wouldn't know where they are used. What's the approval process for entering into them and stuff? I guess at this stage it's too early for you to tell what that system actually is as it's in practice.
So at this point, it's very early days of gathering information. Now, you know, in any given year, we do audit the government financial statements, the public accounts of the province with the materiality levels that are around there. And so whatever processes we would look at there in terms of purchasing or contracting in general within the parameters of that materiality, we do every year. So I would leave that with you.
Order. Okay. Time has expired. We'll move to Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to return to university funding. And I think I left off with the impression that I
that I think Nova Scotians have with the audit, with the comments that most that your office and your audit has shown that most university funding is provided without any accountability, and I know that's been kind of where we've been at over the last little while is accountability and you know ensuring that I think it's important to ensure that the accountability on whatever department or funding formula or services that are out there that there needs to be strong accountability to ensure ensure things are happening in an appropriate way. So in what you have found on page 51, you indicated the department's not regularly monitoring financial health of universities. And that statement, especially in the environment we have currently and the interactions that I've had over the last number of months, especially with university students, with organizations and student groups concerned around the accountability aspect of their universities or their institutions or colleges, specifically when it comes to tuition and the increase in tuition and the lift of tuition cap. And my colleague is correct. I was quite surprised to hear the minister say that tuition was uncapped, when we see university after university after university indicating that they're increasing tuition because of the allowability of the cap being removed. So how I'm trying to wrap my head around the department and the government, if they're not regularly monitoring the financial health of our universities, how could you permit them to increase tuition if that accountability is not there? Am I missing something? Should there not be the monitoring of the financial health of a university? That information should be within the department when they make a decision like removing the cap or allowing universities to increase tuition. And this may be more of a question for the department and for the minister, but I'll ask you, Mr. Pickup, would you think that information is important before you make policy changes or changes within your department that affect students, especially around tuition? Am I off base on this, or would you think that monitoring of the financial health of the university should be implemented before allowing any university to increase tuition without providing information on that? This is why we're increasing tuition. Do you have a comment on that, or should I be holding that comment for the minister or for the department head?
Mr. Pickup.
So I certainly believe that our observations and our recommendations are very important and are critical. I mean, the department continues to operate and continues to do its business. However, the recommendations that we have raised, I think, are very important. And I would draw your attention to paragraph 4.19 on page 57, where the department indicates that the University's Accountability and Sustainability Act indicates the province may require evidence of a university's financial sustainability before providing the full amount of operating funding. However, this process has not been defined. So that leads into our recommendation that really indicates the department should, in consultation with its partners, develop those measures, analyze the trends, do it quickly, and take appropriate action. So I think that really very much addresses your question.
So when I do read that, the province may require evidence of university financial sustainability. Should that not read should require? I mean, they are ultimately accountable. I think in the end, when we're looking at well over $300 million of taxpayers' money going to universities around the province, should that say should require before universities look at potentially raising tuition?
So the reference in here is to what the Act actually says. And I think, regardless of what the Act says, the recommendation is valid and stands, whether it's a should or may. The recommendation, I think, is critical.
Okay, thank you. So how do we ensure that any increase in tuition is adequate or just? You know, that's really what students are asking myself as a critic for labor and advanced education is how, you know, they should be accountable and they should, if the tuition increase is in the works, it should be adequate, it should be just, it should be transparent that this is the reason why. I don't feel that that's in place now with the department not monitoring fully right now the health of the university. Can we agree with that statement? Like, how do we figure out if it's adequate for tuition for a university or college to increase tuition in the environment that we have and in the processes that we have now around the health and sustainability of universities and colleges?
So a couple of points on that. I think one thing, you know, we want to remember is that universities are not part of the government reporting entity. They are outside of government. So, you know, that's important for us to keep in mind as we do our work and for all of us to keep in mind. Now, having said that, these universities in Nova Scotia contribute some $1.4 billion to the economy of Nova Scotia, to the GDP. So very critical to the economy of the province. And now in terms of how the department balances its role in relation to the funding that it gives and the role of tuition costs and the accountability around that, I think that would be a very, you know, good discussion to have with departmental officials in here so that people really understand, you know, on a day-to-day, month-to-month, on-the-ground working level, if you will, what role does the government have play with these private institutions or universities around tuition?
And I would agree. I mean, the importance of having a healthy post-secondary educating field in our province is extremely important to our GDP, as you mentioned, well over $1 billion. But also a significant investment from taxpayers, well over $300 million. So the reporting is something that I think I've heard from a number of people, from people who work, staff, employees of universities and colleges, right down to students. And, you know, the same kind of theme is there, is that often they're left out of the discussion and the not given the information and that around increases and the accountability that each university or college have. So should there be changes in that reporting of universities? You know, should there be more of a transparency with a significant investment made by on behalf of taxpayers when it comes to universities, or is that something that should be continue to be separate?
So what we've audited under is the current sort of structure that we have. So we say recognizing that we have private institutions that are outside of government that receive in total, you know, as you indicated, over $300 million from taxpayers. How can that system work so that the government, recognizing its role as it currently is defined, promotes the long-term sustainability of these organizations? So the recommendations that we have made in here really fall within that context of the governance structure that we have in place.
And I agree. I think we all have a stake, and taxpayers have a stake to ensure that the viability of our universities and colleges remain healthy. In your recommendation 4.5, you indicated that the Department of Labor and Advanced Education should develop and implement a new funding allocation method without further delay. Can you indicate or give us a time frame on what without further delay means? You know, often your recommendations, you'll come back within a couple of years to give an update, but you specifically indicate without further delay. So what kind of time frame would you associate with that comment and that recommendation?
So the in the response, the department has indicated that, you know, given that there can be some significant implications to these changes, that the universities have asked for the new formula to be implemented in 2017-18 to deal with some of these issues. So we're in 15-16 now in terms of fiscal year. 17-18 is within that two-year time frame forward. I would also sort of, you know, drive home the point here again that, you know, these discussions are not theoretical in nature. You know, in paragraph 4.3 on page 52, you know, we do talk about where the province during 2014-15 had to give 4.2 or chose to give 4.2 million in emergency funding, and again that they're predicting without change a $50 million operating deficit by 2018-19. So I don't think time is a friend here of this situation. So certainly we wouldn't want to see it extend beyond that time frame.
So would that meet your recommendation in your mind? Would like that 2017-18 time, would that adequately address without further delay? I'm just trying to indicate or get from you if it should be immediately within the next year. So will that meet your recommendation in your opinion?
So we as auditors try to make recommendations in the context of the scenario that we're in, trying to be reasonable as well, and recognizing that the world is not simple and these situations are often very complex. So having said that, I think the response is a reasonable one. But again, my preoccupation or worry would be not meeting what is indicated, given the situation that the department itself predicts could happen if things aren't addressed.
So if they do address that and they follow through on that recommendation, I mean, would you agree that would have an impact on future tuition rates either way, depending on what they do? I mean, that's the concern I hear from students is that, you know, the tuition increases that they're going to see may be premature because, you know, even in your own report, you've indicated that the government has to address that. You know, is that a correct statement that you know, these changes coming could impact tuition rate either in a positive way or potentially have a negative impact on students?
So the extent of my agreement would be that I would agree that the department should really come in, you know, and answer those types of questions to say how the tuition increases factor in here. Recognizing that the scenario, of course, that we have is these universities are not part of the government and are not under the direct control of government. They are private institutions. So it's not a simplistic situation within which these recommendations are made, and I get that.
Order. Time has expired. We'll now move back to Ms. Miller and the Liberal Caucus.
Yes, I'd like to go back to natural resources again and talk a little bit about, I find that a little concerning about the honor system for evaluating what the subject fees are. And just as a note, too, you know, it's actually very easy to determine because, you know, they have aerial photographs now of the whole province, and I think stumpage can be determined within 10 or 20% just by looking at aerial photographs. So it isn't really hard to figure out if these sectors are being honest or not in their calculations. A little bit about silviculture work as well. Has the department, there are currently processes in place to monitor and verify silviculture work and forest harvesting. So has the department indicated what steps they're taking to formalize and improve the processes?
Mr. Spicer.
Well, the department in their response at the end of the chapter basically agrees with our recommendations that they need to sort of formalize the process and begin to look at it more on a risk-based process and understanding that they have limited resources. So they've accepted that, and in their recommendation or in their response have agreed to establish a risk-based process to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and also about, I know there's a lot of emerging markets in forestry. Can you comment on some of the research that's being done, or what's being, you know, what's going on in that sector?
Really, that's probably better asked the department. We didn't really look at the research that was done. We did. We do know that they've been doing some research as part of the development of the Path We Share strategy. And but specifically, I don't have the sort of the list of all the research that's been done. So I think probably the department would be the best ones to speak to what those emerging markets are and you know how they're looking at those.
One last question, actually. In a Resources Committee meeting, we heard something about the spruce budworm. That's words from way back when, you know, we remember when the forests were decimated in Cape Breton and it hit a lot of Nova Scotia, and they say it's coming back. So do you know what kind of measures are they looking at that now to see what they're going to be able to do to perhaps stop that or control it a little bit? Is there anything there in the report?
What I can say about that is going back to the overall strategy and the Path We Share document that they did, one of the biggest risks to the forest is insects like the spruce budworm. So part of their development of that strategy was looking and putting plans together to address those if they were to happen. So we know that they have plans there. We know that they've developed them. Mm-hmm. The specifics of which, again, the department would probably be the best people to speak to the specifics actions within those plans, but there are definitely plans in place to address those types of things.
Great. Thank you so much.
Ms. Lonis-Croft.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about student achievement because I think that's a priority for the department. I think it's a priority for parents. They want to know how their schools are falling in somewhat of the standardized testing. You refer to that there should be additional student progress data, or it would help to have additional data to give a more complete picture of where schools lie. Can you expand on that? And did you make recommendations to what other processes there are?
Ms. Coleman said.
So right now, most of the information would be limited to provincial assessment results, which, as was discussed earlier this morning, are only in certain grades, mm-hmm. and are limited to numeracy and literacy. Mm-hmm. So we know that there are assessments that are ongoing out in classrooms mm-hmm. throughout the province. You know, teachers would do assessments of students regularly. And in some instances, some of the boards were doing some additional work in their boards as well, over and above the provincial assessments administered through the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. So what we're saying is really that, you know, there needs to be a look at all of those sort of available sources of data, and that perhaps some of that classroom data and whatnot can be drawn on and rolled up and provided to, for example, a governing board, and also even to management, you know, either within schools or to board management, to give them additional information as well.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the former school accreditation process that had been taking place? It's been canceled. It was canceled
government. Not something that I'm tremendously familiar with.
Well, no. It allowed schools to really evaluate and dig deep into where their weaknesses were. You know, I know in the school, one of the schools I was involved in, they found that boys generally did worse than girls in all areas of academic achievement. So that allowed that school to focus on, okay, how do we increase the performance of boys in the classroom and in all their core subjects? So, you know, that program no longer exists, but it did allow for some type of inner focus for individual schools rather than all the schools and having the same process for evaluating students. So I was just curious. That there doesn't seem to be that process except for school improvement plans, right?
Right, there is a
which
continuous
does
school
allow
process,
somewhat. Yeah. But I was just a little concern. You know, standardized testing, we know some children do not do well in written tests, and, you know, that doesn't always give the best and the clearest picture of where students lie. Also, often the children in the bottom are left out of those tests, right, in schools.
So children on an individual program plan,
yes,
would
they are
because
left out,
they're
yes.
not on the regular curriculum,
right.
So and the provincial assessment is geared
so
toward, towards the regular curriculum.
So students who have more students on IPPs, right, would they fare any different?
So IPP yeah. students don't write the
no,
provincial
so there,
assessments.
Yes, but there are some geographic locations and some areas where there are schools that have a higher population. So they would have, I think what I'm finding is a lot of teachers, when you talk to them now, there used to be three levels usually in each classroom, and there's fewer at the top. Now there are more average students now in the schools than there used to be.
I don't know. That isn't something
okay.
that we would have looked at that level. That would be a question for either a board or the
okay.
department.
So did you come up with any recommendations other than, you know, individual teachers? How would that apply in an assessment? Like, how could they bring that into standardized testing to evaluate it on a chart?
I'm not sure I know what you're asking. We do have a recommendation that addresses the need to get additional information on student progress at,
mm-hmm.
at a governing
so
board
level. So how would
level.
That feed into adding on to the standardized testing?
So we aren't suggesting how that should happen. So, you know, whether it's additional standardized testing or not, I think is something for the department and the boards to decide. You know, in the lead into in the discussion that leads into some of those recommendations, we do talk about the fact that there are different types of assessments and whatnot, and assessments out in the classroom. We're not necessarily suggesting that should all be rolled up and be a part of
okay.
a provincial assessment. I think, as you said, you
okay.
know, provincial assessments have sometimes some students may not do well, for example, on those. So different forms of assessment is what we're getting at and gathering that data.
And some local boards may have different needs than other boards. So standardized testing isn't always favorable. What's good for one area, region mm-hmm. of the province may not be good for another area of the province.
Sorry, Mr. Pickup.
This is in part why we say there needs to be performance expectations, because performance expectations should reflect all of the things that you're indicating to come up with what do you expect. So if you look at the chart on page 9, and you go to South Shore, for example, where grade 6 literacy is 60%,
mm-hmm.
grade 6 math is 59%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good or is that bad? Well, I think somebody at the board level should be able to answer that question to say, what are we aiming for here?
Mm-hmm.
Is 60% good or bad in relation to what we're aiming for? If it's not what you expect, then what are you going to do about it to get that to a number that you expect? That fundamentally is what we're talking about here, is what should those numbers be? What do you want them to be? Where are you at? And how are you going to get these things to where you want them to be?
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to switch back to the funding to universities section, if we could, please. And I have to say that earlier this year, when we were being briefed on Bill 100, I was astounded myself at the looseness of the arrangement that existed between the funder, if you will, the province or the taxpayers, and those institutions in our province. And in listening to the tone of the questions today, I think that there's an attempt here being made to lead the public to believe that we're still living in the same situation that we were prior to October of 2013, with that arrangement being assented to by the government. So I want to just highlight a couple of aspects of the Act respecting the accountability and sustainability of universities and how those things fit into your recommendations and the implementation. And it seems pretty clear to me there that The minister has implemented a fairly strong system where there are conditions placed on the grants to universities, and that seems fairly comprehensive to me, and there are pretty clear outcomes that are expected there as well. And in section 19, where it talks about outcome agreements, that those things, they mesh together, and they are going to work together to be a pretty comprehensive accountability scheme as between the funder and the institutions. So could you please comment on how that that act specifically fits in with your recommendations?
Ms. Coleman-Sadd.
So that act was passed after our audit period.
And I fully understand that,
expired.
Yes.
And so, as we've indicated earlier, we don't go back after we immediately after we have put out recommendations. We would go back 2 years later. So in 2 years, if that act is sort of put forward as how some of these recommendations have been addressed, we will look at it at that point in time.
So, but are you familiar with the terms of the act?
I'm not familiar with it in a great level of detail, in that it wasn't part of our audit, so I wouldn't have the level of familiarity that I do with things that were part of the audit. I am, reasonably familiar. I've read the Act.
Okay. So one of the things that I understand that it implements is a standard reporting format that each university will be required to comply with, and they'd be required to put their financial information in a particular form to be reported to the department. It seems to me that would be quite an advance. Would you agree with that?
So I certainly think that standardized financial reporting would be a good step. One of the things with the Act, which was referenced to us by department management and whatnot, is that it really hasn't been determined yet necessarily how all aspects of that are going to be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So really I couldn't speak to whether or not what happens will be sufficient to implement a recommendation or not, because again, those are things that are forward-looking and haven't taken place yet, and that sort of the details of a lot of that are still being worked out.
Okay. But I guess the other thing too that encourages me with respect to the legislation is the connection between those financial reporting requirements and the outcomes that are expected, and the connection between those things and the funding, and the responsibility that's been instituted there. So,
order.
That,
I do apologize. Time has expired. I gave you a little extra time to finish your point there, but time has expired. Thank you to the Auditor General's office for all the work you've done on this report. Mr. Pickup, I'd like you to provide some closing comments for today's session.
Thank you for all of the questions and comments today. And again, I want to say thank you not only to the three people sitting with me here today who have put in a tremendous effort to produce these reports in a fairly short period of time, but also to the 30-plus people who are back in the office who in many ways do all of the hard work to produce these reports, so that rather makes our job easy here. I want to thank you for the questions, particularly around entities that are outside the sort of direct government departments, things like school boards, that really go to the core of what governments do. So I don't have any other terms of closing comments. Looking forward, just to give you an idea of where we're heading, this is the marketing aspect of the presentation, if you will. In April, we will be reporting. So the next time you'll see us do a report is April of 2016. It will be on follow-up. Ms. McDonald will be leading the follow-up of 2 years of recommendations and how they have been implemented. Again, that will be our first time, first time during my time and that I'm aware of us pulling all the recommendations into one report so that we can really focus on what is happening. And a large part of that is in response to what we went through in June of this year, where you as a committee were very interested in implementation, and we were so happy with that that we're doing a separate report. And then in May of 16 will be our next performance audit report. And the chapters that we're covering in that is one on capacity within the health system, which may include looking at up to 20 hospitals across the province as well. So a very, very large audit. We are looking at species at risk. There are nearly 60 species at risk in Nova Scotia, so we're doing an audit of that. We are looking at the government's role in homes for special care, things like nursing homes and other homes for special care as well, and how well that is working. And finally, the fourth audit will be on critical infrastructure within Nova Scotia, and recognizing that, you know, probably 80% of the infrastructure is outside of the government. It's held by the private sector, but we will be looking at the government's role in relationship to dealing with the private sector and other partners, for example, in looking after Nova Scotians' interests in the critical infrastructure that everybody depends on across the province. So that's the marketing aspect of what we have coming up in 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Pickup. We have some committee business. We had a meeting scheduled for December 16th, which is now going to have to take place in the new year because one of the groups is not able to be with us on the 16th. The topic was Chapter 2 of the June 2015 Auditor General Report, and we had requested the IWK Municipal Affairs and Internal Affairs to appear, and one of those is not able to be in attendance on that day, so we will have to move that meeting to the new year. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. We have had correspondence, correspondence from the Department of Finance, which was information requested from the October 21st meeting that was sent to members November 23rd. We also have Office of the Auditor General information requested from the November 4th meeting, and that was sent to members yesterday. If you have any questions in that correspondence, please raise it with myself or the committee clerk. And we had a letter from Mr. Houston requesting an emergency meeting that was sent to members yesterday. I had indicated we would bring it up at today's meeting. Mr. Houston, would you like to comment on this letter and then hear from other members?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just conscious of the time and conscious that this may require a bit of discussion. So through you, Mr. Chair, I'd ask maybe could we have the consent of the committee to chat about this, even if it goes a few minutes past 11 o'clock. But under all circumstances, I'd like us to address this meeting with a vote today and no matter what is. But first off, I'd ask for some consent to allow for some discussion on this, even if it goes past the remaining 9 minutes. Okay.
We do have 9 minutes. Why don't we see how it goes? And if we're getting close to the end, I will ask committee if they would like to continue the discussion. Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess seeing that we now have an opening on December 16th, I would like to propose a way we could fill that opening. And I suggest that we would bring the now former chief of staff to the committee to talk about personal services contracts. And the reason I think that's relevant, even in light of last night's news, and there is precedence for this committee to bring chiefs of staff and those type of people before the committee, because this committee is designed to look at how government money is spent. And I think when you're talking about issues like personal services contracts, you shouldn't really be constrained by materiality levels and things like this, because anytime you have a personal service contract, taxpayers deserve to know that they're getting value for that and that has followed the proper process. And we know through everyone's aware through the media and stuff that the chief of staff, that seemed to be one of his job roles. That was one of his responsibilities, I guess, to dispense personal services contracts. So I think it's relevant for this committee to speak about it. Now, further to that, one of the main objectives of this committee is to support the Auditor General in his work. And I think this committee should do everything it can to support the Auditor General. We heard this morning that the Auditor General is considering doing an audit on personal services contracts. I think the Auditor General, if he was to conduct such an audit, could possibly be frustrated by somebody like the Chief of Staff that's no longer an employee of the province at this stage. By then again, he might be. But at this stage, he's not. But and I don't think the Auditor General would have jurisdiction over him. But this committee certainly would. So as the Auditor General evaluates whether or not he's going to do an audit on personal services contracts, I think that would be this committee could help him in uncovering some information about how they're used by the province. And I think that's something that this committee should do. They should bring the former Chief of Staff before this committee to talk about his understanding of how personal services contracts are used. And I think that would be useful information to the Auditor General as he evaluates whether or not he should do a full audit on personal services contracts. And it would be particularly useful if we could do it sooner rather than later. And being as we have a date open now, I think it would be productive to try and fill it. And I think he'd be an excellent witness. So I look forward to hearing the thoughts on this committee as to whether or not they are interested in supporting the Auditor General in his work, and if they're interested in understanding whether the taxpayers get value for money on the issue of personal services contracts, because the best way to do that is to bring the person who's writing them in to talk about them. So I suggest we bring him in. I look forward to the comments from the committee.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take this opportunity to address the issue. The characterization of this, first off, I want to address the characterization of this as an emergency. Mr. Houston's letter indicates that the issue is an issue of political patronage, and he harkens back to a particular appointment that was made by the Premier in 2013. So the issue's definitely been around for at least that long, and I fail to see why at this point in time it's all of a sudden become an emergency. I would also like to refer to the mandate of the Public Accounts Committee, and there are some very specific things that are set out there. One of them is reviewing the public accounts of the province and reviewing the reports of the Auditor General. And with respect to the purported offer of a personal services contract that was revealed from a surreptitiously recorded conversation, a private conversation, I would add, I think we're in a pretty remote situation there. We're quite far away from the public accounts of the province when we're bringing forward an issue that has arisen in that context. And if the committee is choosing to expand a mandate that broadly and that far afield, with respect to an individual who was an employee at the time but who is no longer an employee, I think we're watering down the business of this committee and the real hard, good work that this committee has to do with respect to reviewing the books and the affairs of the province as they exist. We're not talking about what might exist or what somebody may have offered someone in a secretly taped conversation. So I think that takes us quite far outside of the realm of the mandate of this committee. The idea of bringing someone in here to be cross-examined, if you will, on a conversation that they held in that kind of a context, I think is far outside the mandate of the committee. I think it's also very important to note that all of the parties, whether they be government or opposition, have people in their offices who are on the government payroll, who are engaged in personal services contracts, and who were probably offered their positions in a similar fashion in a private conversation. They may come from any background, any situation, and there's nothing any different that went on in this situation than goes on with all of the parties. I think it's also very significant to note that the Auditor General has expressed an interest in these types of contracts, and if through that office it is determined that personal service contracts will be examined in the course of an audit, then they will clearly come within the mandate of the committee. They will clearly come under the microscope of the Auditor General, the very capable assessment that they have done, that we see every time that they appear here in this committee. And we will then have a proper opportunity to examine them. We're here to look at the work of the Auditor General. We're not here to, as an investigative body, to assist the Auditor General. They're very capable of that. This committee doesn't need to do that. So for all those reasons, Mr. Chair, I submit on behalf of our caucus that this is an inappropriate motion at this time, and it certainly does not constitute an emergency. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. We are getting close to 11 a.m. In fairness, I would like to hear from Ms. McDonald. She has requested, may I have the indulgence of the committee to extend the meeting at least a few minutes past 11 so that she has an opportunity to raise her points, and then perhaps we can just have a vote on this matter. I see agreement. Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, and I thank my colleagues for allowing me time to speak. I want to start by saying I couldn't agree more with the previous speaker that we are here to look at the work of the Auditor General. And I remind committee members that, in fact, the Auditor General, in a previous report not so long ago, has indeed raised concern about personal services contracts in various parts of government, various departments, including issues whether or not these arrangements comply with Canada Revenue Agency and what have you. I asked a few questions at one of our previous meetings when the Department of Finance was here with respect to the personal services contract that the Deputy Minister of PNP has with the Premier's office, where he is incorporated as a corporation, a very unusual arrangement. And there were a number of matters. So I think it is quite appropriate and in keeping with the Auditor General's work of not so long ago. I can't exactly remember. Perhaps the Auditor General can tell us which report this matter was raised in. It was quite recently. It was the June report, perhaps?
Mr. Pickup?
Reports, one on CNS and then one on the procurement chapter that we did in June where we raised the issue.
Thank you. So this isn't a matter that is being brought forward by my colleague out of the air. In fact, it very much is embedded in the work of the Auditor General, and it's very much within the purview of the of this committee. And having the whether or not it's an emergency is immaterial in some ways. We have an opening that has come up on our schedule, and it seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable expectation that we, if we have a topic, we would fill that opening with a relevant topic fitting within the scope of the committee, applying to the work of a previous AG's report. And so I fully support my colleague from Pictou East in what he has brought forward.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Given that I think we've had a chance to hear from each caucus, we should conduct a vote. I would like members to be clear about their position when I ask for or against. The motion that's before us is from Mr. Houston to have an emergency meeting to discuss let's see the letter here, just to be clear, to ask that we convene an emergency meeting of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts with respect to calling upon Principal Secretary Jeff Townsend and the Premier's former Chief of Staff, as of yesterday,
to come to answer questions about personal service contracts. Those opposed to the motion? Those in favor of the motion? The motion is defeated. So we have one other, just a final note. Our next meeting is on December 2nd with the Department of Transportation Infrastructure Renewal to discuss road improvements and repairs. We do have a meeting following this meeting where we have the subcommittee, which will be looking at topics for future meetings. And I expect perhaps this discussion may continue there. But we will now adjourn this portion of the meeting. Thank you.